the Mississippians, Alabamians, and Georgians, in the brigade of General B., who, like Evans, had marched without orders toward the point of danger. All the Cotton States were represented, presently reinforced by Hampton's Legion, which also came onto the field at a critical time. Then, as the tide turned again, the Federals exerting the pressure of their numbers, in war as in peace, the fire-eaters looked to Virginia. On a ridge to their rear, as Johnston and Beauregard had observed, arriving at this moment, Jackson's Virginians were staunchly aligned on their guns. "There is Jackson, standing like a stone wall," B shouted. "Let us determine to die here, and we will conquer." Jackson, too, had arrived at a critical moment, but instead of rushing into the melee on the plain, he had formed his troops on the reverse slope of the ridge, protected from artillery, and ready for whatever moved against them. When an officer came crying, "General, the day is going against us," the stern-lipped Jackson calmly replied, "If you think so, sir, you had better not say anything about it." Another reported, "General, they are beating us back." "Sir, we'll give them the bayonet," Jackson said. Over the crest and down the hill, high on the western leg of the X, the battle raged around a small frame house where the 80-year-old widow Judith Henry lay dying. When the Union troops came pounding south from Sudley Springs, her invalid sons carried her on a mattress to the shelter of a ravine, but she begged so piteously to be allowed to die in her own bed that they brought her back, and there she had her wish. A shell killed her the instant they laid her down, and her body was riddled with bullets as the house began to flame. In a dense blue mass, avenging the months of rebel boasting and insults to the flag, the Federal infantry roared to the attack. The advance had cleared the stone bridge now. Tyler's division poured across, adding its weight to the charge. B fell, shot as he rallied his men, who, leaderless, gave back before the cheering ranks of Federal attackers. On they came, their battle flags slanting forward in the sunlight, up the hill and over the crest, where Jackson's men stood sighting down their muskets. For a moment the blue soldiers were outlined black against the sky, and then it was as if the earth exploded in their faces. One volley struck them, then another, and the survivors stumbled back down the slope, where their officers were shouting for them to reform. By now there were 18,000 Union troops on this quarter of the field. Supported by well-served rifled guns, the men who had been repulsed closed ranks, and presently they charged again, up the slope and over the crest where the Virginians were waiting. But it was too late. The crisis had passed. Johnston and Beauregard had come down off the adjoining hill, Beauregard to ride along the battle line, replacing fallen commanders with members of his staff, and making at intervals a speech in which, he said, he sought to infuse into the hearts of my officers and men the confidence and determined spirit of resistance to this wicked invasion of the homes of a free people. While Johnston established a command post to the rear, at a road intersection where troops from the right and reinforcements from the valley could be rushed to where the issue was in doubt. As fast as they came within reach, he spurred them toward the fight on Henry Hill. There, while the battle raged on the forward slope, disintegrated by now into a strung-out, seemingly disconnected series of hand-to-hand skirmishes by knots of men clustered about their shot-ripped flags, each man fighting as if the outcome of the whole battle depended on himself alone, Beauregard used them to strengthen the line along the crest and to extend the left, where McDowell was attempting to envelop the Confederate defense. The Union commander advanced two batteries of rifled guns, intending to support them with a regiment of New York Fire Zouaves. As these men in baggy trousers were forming off to the right, Colonel J.E.B. Stuart mistook them for an Alabama outfit, similarly clad, which he thought was facing rear, about to retreat. "Don't run, boys, we're here," he cried, riding toward them at the head of his cavalry regiment. By the time he saw his mistake, it was too late to turn back. So he charged, his troopers slashing at the white turbans of the men in blue and scarlet, who panicked and scattered in gaudy confusion, leaving the 11 guns unsupported, and a Virginia infantry regiment ran forward to deliver at 70 yards a volley that toppled every cannoneer. The guns were out of action. Back on the crest, having watched all this, the Confederates were cheering. Jackson rode up and down his line. "Steady, men, all's well," he kept saying. Then, as the Federal infantry pushed forward again, he gave his troops instructions. "Hold your fire until they're on you. Then fire and give them the bayonet. And when you charge, yell like furies." By now, Beauregard had what he had been building toward. Johnston had been feeding him men, including Brigadier General Kirby Smith's brigade from the Valley Army, just off the Cars from Manassas Gap, and Beauregard had built a solid line along both flanks of Jackson, extending the left westward until it not only met the threat from that direction, but overlapped the Federal right. The general was ready, and so were his men, heartened by their recent success and the arrival of reinforcements. About 3:30, as if by signal, the gray line surged forward. "Yell like furies," Jackson had told his soldiers, and now they did. From flank to flank, for the first time in the war, the weird halloo of the rebel yell went up, as if 20,000 fox hunters were closing on a quarry. The Federals had watched the rebel line as it thickened and lengthened to their front and on their flank. Now the opposing forces were roughly equal. But the Blue troops did not know this. They only knew that the enemy was receiving reinforcements while they themselves got none. "Where are our reserves?" they asked in consternation after the scattering of the Zouaves and the loss of their two most effective batteries near the center of the field. Wearied by 13 hours of marching on dusty roads at night and fighting under a July sun, they began to reason that they had been too thoroughly mismanaged for mere incompetence to account for all the blunders. They were angry and dismayed, and from point to point along the front a strange cry broke out. "Betrayed! We are betrayed! Sold out!" When the long gray line sprang at them, bayonets snapping and glinting in the sunlight as the shrill, unearthly quaver of the rebel yell came surging down the slope, they faltered. Then they broke. They turned and fled past officers on horseback, flailing the smoke with sabers while screaming for them to stand. They ran and they kept on running, many of them throwing down their rifles in order to travel lighter and run faster. "Betrayed! Sold out!" some shouted hoarsely as they fled, explaining, as all men apparently always must, the logic behind their fear. So far the retreat was mainly sullen, with more grim anger than panic in the ranks. It had not yet become a rout, though the Southerners were doing what they could to make it one. Kirby Smith had ridden down the line as his troops came off the Cars to form for battle within the sound of guns and the sight of smoke boiling over the northward ridge. "This is the signal, men," he cried, the back of his hand to the bill of his cap. "The watchword is Sumter." It didn't make much sense, but it sounded fine, and the Valley soldiers cheered him riding past. He was wounded as soon as he reached the field. Colonel Arnold Elzey took command. Coming presently into sight of a mass of infantry drawn across the road ahead, whether Union or Confederate, none could tell with the naked eye, Elzey halted the column. As he raised his binoculars, a breeze stirred the drifting smoke. Flags rippled stiffly from their staffs. "Stars and stripes! Stars and stripes! Give it to them, boys!" he yelled, and led his regiments forward at a run. Early's brigade had come up too, their cheers swelling the din on the left as the whole gray line, curving away northeastward along the crest of Henry Hill, came whooping down upon the startled men in blue. While his flanking column fell back over the run, McDowell did what he could to save the day. Two brigades, withdrawn from the fords below Stone Bridge, along with the one reserve brigade and some regiments just arrived from Alexandria, were combined to form a rally line near Centerville in hopes that the retreaters from the crushed right flank would fall in here to challenge the Confederate counterattack. But it was no use. Anger was fast giving way to panic as the retreat gathered momentum. These men were bound for the Potomac along a road that had been traveled prophetically that morning by a regiment of infantry and a battery of field artillery. Their enlistments expiring today, they had declined any share in the battle, and deaf alike to pleas and jeers had returned to Washington for discharge. Panic was contagious. Troops from the proposed rally line fell in with the skulkers going past, and now the more or less sullen retreat became a rout. The column once more harried by the carriages and victorias of the junketing politicians who had driven out to see the Union reestablished. Now, somehow, across the run and down the western leg of that spraddled X, in a roiling cauldron of dust and smoke, with fitful pinkish-yellow stabs of fire mixed in, the carefree lark had been transmuted into something out of a nightmare. "Turn back! Turn back! We are whipped!" the civilians heard the soldiers shout as they came surging up the pike. Darkness spread and the moon came out, a full moon like the one that had flooded the landscape 2 months ago when the Grand Army crossed the Potomac to take potshots at an occasional scampering rebel. Disorderly as the column was, it made good time. In that one night, returning north, McDowell's army covered more distance than it had managed to cover in 3 days of southward marching the week before. On the Confederate side, there was disorganization, too. It was of a different kind, however, proceeding from the elation of victory rather than from the depression of defeat. The two were strangely alike. Belief that the battle was won produced very much the same effect, as far as concerted action went, as belief that the battle was lost. In either case, it was over, and Southern leaders could accomplish no more toward organizing pursuit along the turnpike than their Northern counterparts could accomplish toward organizing a rally line across it. On the left, above Stone Bridge, the regiments were halted for realignment, all possibility of control being gone. While on the right, where the brigades had forced their way across the fords below the bridge, pursuit was abandoned and the men recalled to the south bank of the run to meet a false alarm of an attack at Union Mills. One brigadier, Longstreet, he had already crossed and recrossed the stream 5 times that day, was commanded to fall back just as he gave the order for his batteries to open fire on the retreating Federal column. Stuart's cavalry, swinging wide around Sudley Springs, should have been free to accomplish most. But the troopers soon were burdened with so many prisoners picked up along the way that they lost all mobility, and presently they dwindled to a squad. It was the same all along the line. Little could be done to gather the potential fruits of victory. Even Jefferson Davis, braced for disaster as he rode from Manassas Junction through the backwash of the army, lost some measure of his self-control in the sudden release from anxiety when he emerged to find the Union soldiers fleeing from the charging men in gray. Meeting Colonel Elzey, he conferred the first battlefield promotion of the war. "General Elzey, you are the Blücher of the day." He joined the horseback chase toward Sudley Springs, and everywhere he encountered rejoicing and elation. In the gathering dusk, coming upon a body of men he thought were stragglers, he began a speech to rally them, only to learn that they were Jackson's Virginians who had done so much to win the battle. Their commander was in a nearby dressing station, having a wounded finger bandaged. "Give me 10,000 men," he was saying, "and I would be in Washington tomorrow." Davis rather thought so, too. He rode back to see Johnston and Beauregard at the latter's Manassas headquarters. The generals were as elated as their men, but when the president asked what forces were pushing the beaten enemy, they replied that the troops were confused and hungry and needed rest. Pursuit had ended for the night. Davis was unwilling to reconcile himself to this, but presently a slow rain came on, turning the dust to mud all over eastern Virginia, and there was no longer even a question of the possibility of pursuit. Out on the field, along the turnpike and the run, and in the angles of the X they formed, the drizzle soaked the dead and fell upon the wounded of both armies. Among them was Major Robert O. Wheat, commander of the Louisiana Tigers, who had opened the fight alongside Evans above Stone Bridge. He was a lawyer and had been a soldier of fortune, fighting with Caravallal in Mexico, Walker in Nicaragua, and Garibaldi in Sicily. But now a Union bullet had gone through both of his lungs, and a surgeon told him he must die. "I don't feel like dying yet," Wheat said. The doctor insisted. "There is no instance on record of recovery from such a wound." "Well, then," the lawyer-soldier replied, "I will put my case on record." Next morning at breakfast, Davis rode out for Beauregard, subject to the approval of Congress, a promotion to full general. Then he returned to Richmond, where the bodies of General B. and other leaders killed on yesterday's field were to lie in state, with honor guards and fitting obsequies. In spite of such causes for individual grief, the people in the capital were as elated as the soldiers around Manassas. Here, as there, the feeling was that the Yankees had been shown for once and for all. The war was won. Independence was a fact beyond all doubt. Even the casualty lists, the source of their sorrow, reinforced their conviction of superiority to anything the North could bring against them. The Confederates had lost almost 2,000, but the Union Army had lost more than 3,000. 387 were dead in gray, 481 in blue. Only among the wounded were the Northerners outnumbered, 1,582 to 1,124, and this in itself was interpreted as a credit to the South. What, they asked, could be nobler than for a soldier to bleed for his country? However, they found the principal support for their opinion in the amount of captured equipment and the number of prisoners taken. 1,500 Yankees had thrown down their arms and submitted to being marched away to prison, while in the Confederate ranks only 8 were listed as missing, and no one believed that even these had surrendered. Equipment captured during the battle or garnered from the field when the fighting was over included 28 artillery pieces, 17 of them rifled, as well as 37 caissons, 500,000 rounds of small arms ammunition, 500 muskets, and 9 flags. Later in the week, while Southern outpost riders once more gazed across the Potomac at the spires of Washington, the wounded were brought to Richmond to be cared for, including Rob Wheat, who had put his case on record. The ladies turned out with an enthusiasm which sometimes tried the patience of the men. Asked if he wanted his face washed, one replied, "Well, ma'am, it's been washed 20 times already, but go ahead if you want to." Prisoners came to Richmond, too, where a 3-story tobacco warehouse had been hurriedly converted into a military prison. From the sidewalk, citizens tried to bribe the guards for a glimpse at a real live Yankee, especially New York Congressman Alfred Ely, who had strolled too near the scene of battle just as the lines gave way, and was discovered trying to hide behind a tree. President Davis sent him 2 fine white wool blankets to keep him warm in the warehouse prison, and the people in general approved of such chivalry. They felt that they could afford to be magnanimous, now that the war was won. Lincoln, who had gone out for his Sunday drive believing the battle a Union victory, returned at sundown to find that the Secretary of State had come looking for him, white and shaky, and had left a message that McDowell had been whipped and was falling back. Hurrying to the War Department, he read a telegram confirming the bad news. "General McDowell's army in full retreat through Centerville. The day is lost. Save Washington and the remnants of this army." He returned to the White House and spent the night on a sofa in the cabinet room while bedraggled politicians, with the startled expressions of men emerging from nightmares, brought him eyewitness accounts of the disaster. Next morning, through windows lashed by rain, he watched his soldiers stagger up the streets, many of them so exhausted that they stumbled and slept in yards and on the steps of houses, oblivious to the pelting rain and the women who moved among them offering coffee. General Scott and others with long faces soon arrived. "Sir, I am the greatest coward in America," Scott told one of them. "I deserve removal because I did not stand up when my army was not in condition for fighting and resist it to the last." Lincoln broke in, "Your conversation seems to imply that I forced you to fight this battle." The old general hesitated. He believed this was quite literally true, but he would not be rude. "I have never served a president who has been kinder to me than you have been," he said evasively, leaving Lincoln to draw from this what solace he could. While Davis was soaring from anxiety to elation and Lincoln was moving in the opposite direction, downhill from elation to anxiety, others around the country and the world were reacting according to their natures. Horace Greeley, who had clamored for invasion, removed the banner "Forward to Richmond" from the masthead of his New York Tribune, and after what he called "my seventh sleepless night, yours too, doubtless," wrote to Lincoln, "On every brow sits sullen, scorching, black despair. If it is best for the country and for mankind that we make peace with the rebels at once and on their own terms, do not shrink even from that." Tecumseh Sherman, reassembling his scattered brigade, wrote privately, "Nobody, no man can save the country. Our men are not good soldiers. They brag but don't perform, complain sadly if they don't get everything they want, and a march of a few miles uses them up. It will take a long time to overcome these things, and what is in store for us in the future I know not." One English journalist, at least, believed he could guess what was in store. "So short-lived has been the American Union," the London Times observed, "that men who saw its rise may live to see its fall." Allowing for journalistic license, sullen, scorching black despair was scarcely an overstatement. All along the troubled line from Missouri to the Atlantic, the gloom was lighted at only one point. In western Virginia, scene of the Philippi races and the rout at Carrick's Ford, there was a commander with a Napoleonic flair who lifted men's hearts and brought cheers. Lincoln looked in that direction, the long, sad face grown longer and sadder in the past few hours, and there he believed he found his man of destiny. On that same Monday, while fugitives from Sunday's battle still limped across Long Bridge and slept in the rain, he summoned him by telegraph. "General George B. McClellan, Beverly, Virginia. Circumstances make your presence here necessary. Charge Rosecrans or some other general with your present department, and come hither without delay." 2. Lincoln was already dealing with two men of destiny, Robert Anderson, the hero of Sumter, and John Charles Fremont, the California Pathfinder. They were to save Kentucky and Missouri for the Union, both having ties in the states to which they had been sent. Anderson was a bluegrass native, and Fremont, though Georgia-born, had made important Missouri connections by eloping with the daughter of old Thomas Hart Benton, who lived long enough to be reconciled to the match. In Kentucky, the contest was political, swinging around the problem of the state's declared neutrality. Her sympathies were Southern, but her interests lay northward, beyond the Ohio, Lincoln having guaranteed the inviolability of her property and slaves. What was more, her desire for peace was reinforced by the knowledge that her "dark and bloody ground," as it was called, would be the scene of bitterest fighting if war came. Therefore, after the furor of Sumter and the departure into Confederate ranks of the eastern border states and Tennessee, the governor and both houses of the legislature announced that Kentucky would defend her borders north and south against invaders from either direction. And the people signified their approval in the special congressional election of late June, when 9 of the 10 men sent to Washington were Unionists, and again in the August legislature races, which also were overwhelming Union victories. Meanwhile, Kentucky had become a recruiting ground for agents of both armies. The state militia, under Simon Bolivar Buckner, a West Pointer and a wealthy Kentucky aristocrat, was the largest and probably the best-drilled body of non-regular troops in the country. Its 10,000 members were pro-Confederate, but this threat was countered by the Home Guard, swiftly organized under William Nelson, a 6-foot-5-inch, 300-pound U.S. Navy lieutenant, who distributed 10,000 Lincoln rifles among men of strong pro-Union beliefs. Whatever caution their political leaders might show, Kentuckians did not stand aside from individual bloodshed. 35,000 would fight for the South before the war was over, while more than twice that many would fight for the North, including 14,000 of her Negroes. Here the conflict was quite literally a war of brothers. Senator John J. Crittenden typified the predicament of his state. He, who had done so much for peace, had two sons who became major generals in the opposing armies. Likewise, Henry Clay, that other great compromiser, had three grandsons who fought to preserve the Union and four who enlisted on the other side. All over the state, instances such as these were reproduced and multiplied. Fathers and sons, brothers and cousins were split on issues that split the nation. Kentucky was in truth a house divided. The question was in which direction the house would fall. Commissioned a brigadier after the public acclaim that greeted him when he landed in New York from Fort Sumter, Anderson was sent west in late August. He had said that his heart was not in the struggle, that if Kentucky seceded he would go to Europe and wait the war out. But now that his native state expressed intentions of holding firm, he determined to take the field. Frail and aged beyond his 56 years, he was warned by his physicians that he might break under the stress of active duty, to which, according to a Washington newspaper interview, he replied that the Union men of Kentucky were calling on him to lead them and that he must and would fall in a most glorious cause. Out of respect for his state's declared neutrality and despite his official designation as commander of the military department of Kentucky, he established headquarters in Cincinnati, just across the Ohio, and attempted to direct operations from there. He did little, for there was little he could do, which gave the impression that he was biding his time, waiting for the bluegrass leaders to evolve their own decisions unmolested. Considering their touchy sensibilities, so violently in favor of peace that they were willing to fight for it, this was the best he could possibly have done. It was more, at any rate, than his opponent Leonidas Polk could do. Polk was a West Pointer who had gone into the ministry and done well. Aged 55 at the outbreak of the war, he was Episcopal Bishop of Louisiana. Visiting Richmond in June, he dropped by to see his academy schoolmate Jefferson Davis. And when he emerged from the president's office, he held, to his surprise, the commission of a Confederate major general and appointment to the command of troops in the Mississippi Valley. Northerners expressed horror at such sacrilege, but Southerners were delighted with this transfer from the army of the Lord. Polk himself, considering his new duty temporary, did not resign his bishopric. He felt, he said, like a man who has dropped his business when his house is on fire to put it out, for as soon as the war is over I will return to my proper calling. Just now, however, the Bishop General was alarmed at the development of events in Kentucky, which had gone from bad to worse from the Confederate point of view. Not only was the legislature pro-Unionist, but in mid-July, feeling that his position was somehow dishonorable or anyhow equivocal, Buckner resigned as head of the militia, which then disbanded, its guns and equipment passing into the hands of the Home Guard. At this rate, Kentucky would soon be irretrievably gone. One of the first things Polk did when he arrived at his Memphis headquarters was to order a concentration of Confederate troops at Union City in northwest Tennessee, prepared to cross the border and occupy Columbus, Kentucky, which Polk saw as the key to the upper Mississippi, whenever some federal act of aggression made such a movement plausible. Anderson, marking time in Cincinnati, would give him no such provocation. But Fremont, across the way, was more precipitate. On August 28th, he instructed Brigadier General Ulysses S. Grant to take command of a combined forward movement and to occupy Columbus, Kentucky, as soon as possible. That city's pro-Southern citizens had already petitioned the Confederates to march to their defense, and now that he had an excuse, Polk moved quickly, not waiting to deal with an accomplished act of aggression, but hastening to forestall one. He ordered his troops to cross the border. They occupied Columbus on September 4th, the day before the Federals were scheduled to arrive. Grant, thus checked, countered by crossing the border and occupying Paducah, strategically located at the junction of the Ohio and the Tennessee. Now both Confederate and Union soldiers, in rapid sequence, had violated Kentucky's declared neutrality. The reaction, which was immediate, was directed mainly against the Southerners, since they had entered first and could make a less effective show of moral indignation. Anderson left Cincinnati at last, transferring his headquarters to Frankfort, where he appeared before the legislature on September 7th and was given an ovation. 4 days later, though it sent no such angry communication to Grant or Fremont, this body issued a formal demand that the Confederacy withdraw its troops. When this injunction was not obeyed, it passed on the 18th an act creating a military force to expel them. Neutrality was over. Politically, Kentucky had chosen the Union. She had a star in the Confederate flag and a secessionist legislature at Russellville, but these represented hardly anything more than the Kentuckians in the Southern Army. If she was to be reclaimed, if the northern boundary of the new nation was to reach the natural barrier of the Ohio, it would have to be accomplished by force of arms. Much of the credit was due Anderson, who had waited. He had spoken of glory on setting out, but there had been little of that for him in his native Kentucky. He had said goodbye to glory in Charleston Harbor. And now his physician's prediction came true. His health broke and he was given indefinite sick leave, Sherman replacing him in mid-October. Thus the Union's first man of destiny left the scene. Afterwards brevetted a major general and retired, he spent the war years in New York City. Pointed out on the avenue as he took his daily constitutional, still the hero of Sumter, wearing a long military cloak across his shoulders to hide his stars. He read the war news in the papers and took a particular pride in the career of Sherman, who had served under him as a junior lieutenant in the peacetime army. "One of my boys," he called him. Lincoln's second man of destiny was quite different from the first, as indeed he had need to be. In Missouri, the secession question had long since passed the political stage. Here there was bloodshed from the outset, and all through the last half of the opening year it was touch and go. A series of furious skirmishes, marches, and counter-marches by confused commanders, occupations, evacuations, and several full-scale battles. Jesse James studied tactics here, and Mark Twain skedaddled. Whatever talents Fremont might show, and he was reputed to have many, the ability to wait and do nothing was not one of them. Heading westward on the day of McDowell's defeat on the plains of Manassas, he fell into Missouri's seething cauldron toward the end of July when he established headquarters in St. Louis. Apprised of the situation, disaffection throughout the state, bands of marauders roaming at will, Confederates massed along the southern border, he sent telegrams in all directions, from Washington, D.C. out to California, calling for reinforcements. None were forthcoming, but apparently relieved just by the effort of having tried, Fremont settled down at once to making plans for the future. Something of a mystic, he was a man of action, too, and within the widening circle of his glory, he had a magnetism that drew men to him. With the help of such guides as Kit Carson, he had explored and mapped the Rocky Mountain passes through which settlers came west. Under his leadership, the Pathfinder, they called him, they broke California loose from Mexico and joined her to the Union, rewarding Fremont by making him one of her first two senators, as well as one of her first millionaires, and subsequently the Republican Party's first presidential nominee. He was in France at the outbreak of the war, but he came straight to Washington, where Lincoln made him a major general and sent him westward. His slender yet muscular body evidenced a youthfulness which the touches of gray in his hair and beard only served to emphasize by contrast, as if they represented not so much his 48 years, but rather the width of experience and adventure he had packed into them. His features were regular, his glance piercing. There was drama in his gestures, and his voice had overtones of music. "I have given you carte blanche. You must use your own judgment and do the best you can," Lincoln had told him, saying goodbye on the portico of the White House, and now, in Missouri, Fremont took him at his word. While the news from Manassas dampened Unionist spirits, he continued to exorcise dismay with works and projects. After ordering entrenchments thrown around St. Louis to secure it from attack, he occupied and fortified Cape Girardeau above Cairo, as well as the railheads at Ironton and Rolla, and the state capital at Jefferson City. Such actions were mainly defensive, but Fremont had offensive conceptions as well, and of these such occupations were a part. Poring over strategic maps in his headquarters, which he saw as the storm center of events, he looked beyond the present crisis and evolved a master plan for federal efforts in the West. Whoever controlled the trunk controlled the tree. Whoever held the Mississippi Valley, he discerned from his coign of vantage, would hold the country by the heart. Missouri was only a starting point, elemental but essential to the plan, of which the great object was the descent of the Mississippi River. With Memphis and Vicksburg lopped off, and finally New Orleans, the Confederacy would wither like a tree with a severed taproot. Cairo was the key, and having secured it, he went ahead. He began construction of 38 mortar boats and 2 gunboats to scour the rivers, and ordered Grant to seize Columbus, or, as it turned out, since Polk moved first and thereby won the race and lost Kentucky, Paducah, which served as well. Whatever fit the plan got full attention, whatever did not fit got brushed aside. Some, in fact, found him too vague and exalted for their taste. Grant, for example, who recorded, "He sat in a room in full uniform with his maps before him. When you went in, he would point out one line or another in a mysterious manner, never asking you to take a seat. You left without the least idea of what he meant or what he wanted you to do." It was true that he was difficult to get at. To protect his privacy from obscure brigadiers like Grant while he worked 18 hours a day in the 3-story St. Louis mansion which served as headquarters, he had a bodyguard of 300 men. The very best material Kentucky could afford, average height 5 feet 11.5 inches and measuring 40.5 inches around the breast. Resplendent in feathers and loops of the gold braid known locally as chicken guts, his personal staff included Hungarians and Italians with titles such as Adlatus to the Chief, and names that were hardly pronounceable to a Missouri tongue. Emavich, Maitsaras, Kalamanutse were 3 among many. The list ran long, causing one of his Confederate opponents to remark as he read it, "There's too much tail to that kite." Whether he would soar or not, Fremont kept his gaze on far horizons. Down in the southwest corner of the state, he had a compact, well-drilled army of 6,000, including 1,200 regulars and several batteries of artillery. Its commander, Brigadier General Nathaniel Lyon, had been active against rebellion from the start. Back in May, disguised in women's clothes, including a bonnet and veil to hide his red hair and whiskers, he had ridden in an open carriage to reconnoiter a secessionist camp. Afterwards, he surrounded the place, forced its surrender under the muzzles of his guns, and marched the would-be Confederates off to prison, shooting down 2 dozen civilians when a crowd on the streets of St. Louis attempted to interfere. By similar forthright action, he had saved for the Union the arms in the federal arsenal there. He was a hard-bitten, capable New Englander, 43 years old, well acquainted with violence and well adapted for countering that particular brand of it being met with in Missouri. "I was born among the rocks," he once remarked. So far, however, Lyon had no part in the plan Fremont was spending long hours evolving. In June, he had led his troops southwest, intending to secure that section of the state and then move into Arkansas, with Little Rock as his goal. By early August, he was beyond Springfield, near the border, but breakdowns along his line of supply had made his army ragged, ill-shod, low on ammunition, and disheartened. Fremont, intent on his master plan, could send no reinforcements. What was worse, the Confederates encamped to Lyon's front around Cowskin Prairie were growing stronger every day. He estimated their strength at 20,000. It was impractical to advance. On August 4th, he reported, "I am under the painful necessity of retreating and can at most only hope to make my retreat good. I am in too great haste to explain more fully." On the 6th, he fell back to a position around Springfield, and the Confederates came on after him, pausing a few miles south before making the final pounce. They were not as formidable as Lyon thought, and for several reasons. Though they numbered about 12,000, twice the size of the Union force, for the most part they were miserably equipped and poorly organized, under commanders who were divided in their counsels and ambitions. The majority were Missouri militia, led by Sterling Price, a 52-year-old Virginia-born ex-governor who thought so little of West Pointers that he inserted a notice in the papers, indignantly quashing a rumor that he had received a formal military education. His men had neither uniforms nor tents. Many had no arms at all, while others had only shotguns or 1812-style flintlocks, and as substitutes for artillery projectiles, they had laid in a stock of smooth stones, rusty chains, and iron rods to be shot from their 8 antiquated cannon. The remainder, under Ben McCulloch of Tennessee, 40 years old and a former Texas Ranger, were somewhat better equipped, being regular Confederate troops. Price was a major general, McCulloch a brigadier, both veterans of the Mexican War, but the latter, who held his commission directly from Richmond, did not feel that the former should outrank him, and refused to combine the two forces unless the Missourian would yield command. Price, called Old Pap by his men, they asserted that their general had won more battles in Mexico than McCulloch ever witnessed, was so anxious to fall upon Lyon that he agreed to the stipulation. As soon as Lyon began his retreat, McCulloch led the combined forces after him. They went into camp along Wilson's Creek, 10 miles short of Springfield, where the Federals had halted. McCulloch drew up plans for attack. The movement began on August 9th, but was called off because of threatening rain. The troops returned to camp and settled down to sleep, not bothering to put out pickets. At dawn, the storm of Lyon's attack exploded in their rear. The red-haired Federal was also a veteran of Mexico, where he had won promotion for valor, capturing 3 guns at Cerro Gordo. In the spirit of those days, instead of waiting to receive attack or risking being struck while in motion, he had decided to deliver a blow that would permit him to retreat unmolested. The fact that he was outnumbered 2-1, 3-1, as he thought, did not discourage this, but rather, in Lyon's eyes at any rate, demanded it. He felt that his army would do a better job of delivering an attack than of standing to receive one. With his men somewhat heartened by a day's rest and the arrival of shoes from the railhead at Rolla, he distributed the shoes on the afternoon of the 9th and set out south for Springfield. Soon after midnight, the Confederates, having averted a meeting engagement by turning back in the face of lowering weather, he had his troops within striking distance of the rebel camp on Wilson's Creek. He had not minded the rain, and he counted the darkness a positive advantage. Under its cover, he disposed his army for one of those complicated envelopments so popular in the early days of the war, when the generals and the soldiers they commanded were least capable of executing them. One column, under Colonel Franz Siegel, 2 regiments of infantry, 2 troops of cavalry, and a 6-gun battery of artillery, was sent on a wide swing to hit the enemy rear, while Lyon struck in front with the main body, southward down the western bank where most of the rebels lay snug in their blankets. He detached 1 regiment of regulars, 1st Infantry U.S. Army, about as regular as troops could be, sending them beyond the creek to handle whatever Confederates might have pitched their camps on that side. Siegel set out. Lyon waited in the darkness. Nothing stirred in the rebel camp. As dawn paled the rising ground beyond the creek, the limbs of trees coming black against the sky, there was a sudden spatter of musketry. The skirmishers had opened fire. Then the roar and flash of guns like summer lightning on the far horizon. Siegel had come up from the south and was in action, on time and in place. Lyon ordered the main body forward, east and west of the creek, closing the upper jaw of his tactical vice. Everything was moiling confusion in the camps along the creek bed, guns booming north and south as men came out of their blankets in various stages of undress, tousle-haired, half-asleep, and badly frightened. Under the stress of that first panic, many fled. Some returned, rather shamefaced. Others ran and kept on running, right out of the war. Yet those who stood were hardcore men from Arkansas and Louisiana, Texas and Missouri, wanting only to be told what to do. McCulloch and his aides soon established a line of resistance, and these men fell in eagerly. Price had yielded the command, but he was there too, his white hair streaming in the wind as he rode up and down the line of his rallied Missourians, shouting encouragement. Under such leadership, the Southerners assembled in time to meet the attack from both directions. The battle that followed set the pattern for all such encounters in the West. Few of the romantic preconceptions as to brilliant maneuver and individual gallantry were realized. Fighting at close quarters because of the short-range Confederate flintlocks and muzzle-loading fowling pieces, the regiment would walk up to the firing line, deliver a volley, then reload and deliver another, continuing this until it dissolved and was replaced by another regiment, which repeated the process, melting away in the heat of that furnace and being in turn replaced. No fighting anywhere ever required greater courage, yet individual gallantry seemed strangely out of place. A plume in a man's hat, for example, accomplished nothing except to make him a more conspicuous target. Nor did the rebel yell ring out on the banks of Wilson's Creek. There was little cheering on either side, for a cheer seemed as oddly out of place as a plume. The men went about their deadly business of firing and reloading and melting away, in a grim silence broken only by the rattling crash of musketry and the deeper roar of guns, with the screams of the injured sometimes piercing the din. Far from resembling panoplied war, it was more like reciprocal murder. In such a battle, the weight of numbers told. Siegel's surprise attack from the south became a rout almost as soon as he encountered resistance. His men broke, stampeded, and did not stop till they got back to Springfield, having abandoned their colors and all but one of their guns. To the north, Lyon's men were wavering too. East of the creek, the regulars, lacking reinforcements, were blasted off the field. The main body, west of the creek, stood manfully to their work for a while, but presently the Confederates clustering thicker and thicker to their front, new regiments arriving after their success in dealing with other columns of attack, the Federals began to look back over their shoulders, apprehensive. Lyon rode among them, calling for them to stand firm in the face of gathering resistance. As he sought thus to rally them, a bullet creased his scalp. A second struck his thigh, a third his ankle. His horse was shot and fell dead under him. Stunned, Lyon limped slowly toward the rear, shaking his head. "I fear the day is lost," he said. Presently, though, recovering from the shock and depression, he secured another mount and rode again into the fight at a place where the troops were about to give way. Swinging his hat, he called for them to follow him, and when they rallied, he led them forward. Near the point of deepest penetration, a bullet struck his heart, and he went down. His men fled, shaken by the loss of their red-bearded leader. It was Manassas all over again. Once the Federal troops gave way, they did not stand upon the order of their going, but retreated pell-mell to Springfield and then to Rolla, leaving their fallen comrades on the field. Kansas, Missouri, and Iowa farm boys lying dead in their new shoes, and the brave Lyon, whose body McCulloch forwarded through the lines under a flag of truce, only to recapture it when the Unionists fell back from Springfield, abandoning it in its coffin in the courthouse. The fighting had been bloody, The severest battle since Waterloo, one participant called it. Within 4 hours, each side had suffered about 1,200 casualties. In one-third the time, and with less than one-third the number of troops involved, more than half as many men had fallen along Wilson's Creek as had fallen along Bull Run. Yet here, too, as after that battle 3 weeks before, on the banks of that other rural stream 800 miles away, one side was about as disorganized by victory as the other was by defeat. Though there was broad open daylight for pursuit, the Confederates could not be put into column to press the retreating Federals. All the same, the battle was taken as further proof, if such was needed, of the obvious superiority of the Southern fighting man, and in Missouri as in Virginia there was the feeling that, now that the Yankees had been shown what they were up against, there was no real need for giving chase. In Richmond, President Davis announced the victory in much the same tone of quiet exultation he had used for the announcement in July. Then, out of respect for Missouri's neutrality, he ordered McCulloch to return to Arkansas with his Confederate troops, awaiting an invitation from the secessionist legislature soon to assemble in Neosho, Lyon having scattered them from Jefferson City in July. Price and his native militiamen followed slowly as the Federals fell back. The battle was therefore inconclusive in results, since Lyon had been retreating anyhow. One thing it did, at any rate, it removed Fremont's transfixed gaze from far horizons. The lopping descent of the Mississippi could never be accomplished without Missouri under control. Galvanized by reports of the battle, which indicated that he was in danger of losing his starting point, he reacted first according to pattern, wiring the Secretary of War for reinforcements. "Let the governor of Ohio be ordered forthwith to send me what disposable force he has. Also governors of Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Order the utmost promptitude." This done, though nothing came of it, he sent 5 regiments to strengthen the defeated men at Rolla and declared martial law in St. Louis. Other rebel columns were reported to be advancing, however, and all over the northern portion of the state, guerrillas were coming out of hiding, emboldened by Confederate successes. As the month wore on, Fremont realized that something had to be done to stem the tide. The week before the battle, Congress had passed a Confiscation Act, prescribing certain penalties against persons in rebellion. Now Fremont issued a proclamation of his own, with real teeth in it, written in one night and printed for distribution the following morning. Drawing a line from Fort Leavenworth to Cape Girardeau, he directed that any unauthorized person found under arms north of this line would be tried by court-martial, the sentence being death before a firing squad. In addition, he announced as confiscated the property, real and personal, of all Missourians who should be proved to have taken an active part with their enemies in the field. Nor was that all. "And their slaves, if any they have," he added, "are hereby declared freemen." Emancipation. Feared or hoped for, the word had been spoken at last. The reaction came from several directions, first from down in the southeast corner of the state, where the Missouri Brigadier M. Jeff Thompson issued a proclamation of his own. "For every member of the Missouri State Guard or soldier of our allies, the Confederate States, who shall be put to death in pursuance of said order of General Fremont," he avowed, "I will hang, draw, and quarter a minion of said Abraham Lincoln. So help me God." Throughout the North, on the other hand, anti-slavery radicals were delighted. They had wanted a proclamation such as Fremont's all along, and now they had a champion who said plainly, "War consists not only in battles, but in well-considered movements which bring the same results." In Kentucky, the reaction was otherwise. A Unionist volunteer company threw down its arms on receiving the news, and the legislature balked on the verge of landing the state officially in the federal camp. Lincoln thus was caught between two fires, having to offend either the abolitionist wing of his own party, which clamored for emancipation, or the loyal men of the border states who had been promised non-intervention on the slavery question. 3 of the latter wired from Louisville, "There is not a day to be lost in disavowing emancipation, or Kentucky is gone over the mill dam." Lincoln was circumspect, threading his way. He wrote to Fremont in a spirit of caution and not of censure, explaining the predicament and requesting that the Pathfinder modify the edict so as to conform to the recent act of Congress. As for the use of firing squads, he reminded the general that the Confederates would retaliate man for man indefinitely, and directed that no shootings were to take place without presidential approval. Fremont waited 6 days, then replied that he would not change or shade it. It was worth a victory in the field, he earnestly maintained. As commander-in-chief, Lincoln could order it modified, otherwise the proclamation stood. This letter was entrusted to no ordinary courier, but was taken to Washington by Jesse Benton Fremont, an illustrious father's ambitious daughter, who had been at her husband's elbow all the while. She arrived after 2 days and nights on the cars and, despite the late hour at which she checked into Willard's, sent a note to the White House asking when she might deliver the message. A card was brought. "Now, at once, A. Lincoln." She had not had time to rest or change her clothes, but she went immediately. The president was waiting. "Well," he said. She found his manner hard, she later declared, and when she handed him the letter he smiled, with an expression not agreeable. When she attempted to reinforce her husband's defense of the proclamation, enlarging upon his explanation that the war must be won by more than the force of arms, and that Europe would cheer a blow struck at slavery, Lincoln interrupted her lecture by remarking, "You are quite a female politician." At this, she lost her temper and reminded Lincoln that the Pathfinder was beyond the ordinary run of soldiers. If the president wanted to try titles, he would find Fremont a worthy adversary. "He is a man, and I am his wife," she added hotly. Lincoln had not doubted that Fremont was a man or that Jesse was his wife, but having stirred up this hornet's nest, he mustered what tact he could to try to calm her. It was not enough. "She left in anger," he said afterwards, "flaunting her handkerchief before my face." Returning westward, she traveled in the wake of a letter addressed to her husband in St. Louis. Signed, "Your obedient servant, A. Lincoln," it began, "Yours of the 8th in answer to mine of the 2nd instant is just received," and remarked that while the president perceived in general no objection to the proclamation, he could not allow an act of Congress to be overridden. Therefore, he would assume responsibility for revoking so much of Fremont's edict as failed to conform to that act. "Your answer expresses the preference on your part that I should make an open order for the modification, which I very cheerfully do." Thus he drew the teeth of the proclamation for the sake of the border unionists, while for the sake of the abolitionists, he explained that this was done not because of its policy, to which he perceived in general no objection, but simply because it was unlawful, interfering as it did with the prerogative of Congress, where the most vociferous of the abolitionists sat. Such wary action pacified the conservatives, but the anti-slavery radicals were by no means satisfied. In this first open break within his party, Lincoln was assailed on the floor of the Senate, in the press, and from the pulpit. Protests were especially loud among the German emigrants in Missouri, the St. Louis Dutch, their enemies called them, whose devotion to the general was redoubled. Jesse Fremont's threat that her husband might set up for himself and try titles with the president began to seem quite possible. Meanwhile, alarming reports of a different kind were arriving from the West, where $12 million had gone down the drain for steamboats, fortifications, uniforms, food, and ice for sherry cobblers. Graft and extravagances were charged against the men surrounding Fremont. A gang of California robbers and scoundrels, the head of a congressional investigating committee called them, adding that while the general refused to confer with men of honor and wisdom, these boodlers rule, control, and direct everything. Lincoln wrote to Major General David Hunter, who had commanded the flanking column at Manassas, saying of Fremont, "He needs to have by his side a man of large experience. Will you not for me take that place? Your rank is one grade too high to be ordered to it, but will you not serve the country and oblige me by taking it voluntarily?" Hunter knew well enough what was meant. He also knew an opportunity when he saw one, and he set out at once for St. Louis. There was a need for military wisdom and alertness, for bushwhackers were plundering the state while Price moved northward with his 15,000 militia, their shortage of arms somewhat repaired by 3,000 Union rifles picked up after the fight at Wilson's Creek. At Lexington, they besieged Mulligan's Irish Guard, 2,800 men entrenched on the campus of the Masonic College. Price was low on percussion caps, but when a supply arrived in mid-September, he attacked, keeping his casualties down by advancing his men behind water-soaked bales of hemp, which they jimmied along as a sort of sliding breastwork. The Irish surrendered, and Price, with 3,000 more rifles and a single-handed victory to his credit, issued a call for his fellow Missourians to flock to his standard. "Do I hear your shouts? Is that your war cry which echoes through the land? Are you coming? 50,000 men! Missouri shall move to victory with the tread of a giant. Come on, my brave boys, 50,000 heroic, gallant, unconquerable Southern men. We await your coming." Once more, Fremont was galvanized. "I am taking the field myself," he telegraphed Washington. "Please notify the president immediately." He assembled 5 divisions, 38,000 men, and set out after Price. He had not lost sight of his goal, however. "My plan is New Orleans straight," he wrote his wife October 7th from Tipton, adding, "I think it can be done gloriously."